This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, broadcasting from the campus of Michigan State University. I'm Russ White. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability roundtable discussion in our Greening of the Great Lakes segment.
Well, as we transition from 2013 to 2014, we're going to do something new this week. A panel discussion on some of the major sustainability and environmental issues facing Michigan and the Great Lakes region. We have a panel that's comprised of three very informed and articulate individuals who are deeply committed to sustainability and who also represent organizations who are loyal sponsors of Greening of the Great Lakes. So let me introduce our panel. First, we have Diane Byram, a well-known name in Michigan, former legislative leader, now a partner in the Byram and Fisk Advocacy Communications Firm and a member of the MSU Board of Trustees. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Kirk.
I should say welcome back to the show.
Yes, that's right.
We have Mark Schupan, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Schupan & Sons, which is headquartered in Kalamazoo. Schupan & Sons began in 1968 as a non-ferrous industrial scrap processor, and over the past 44-plus years has grown into a national and international business. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And finally, last but not least, we have Dr. Doug Bueller. Doug is the director of MSU Ag Bioresearch and senior associate dean for research at the College of Ag and Natural Resources. Doug has also been a frequent guest on this program. Welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Always a pleasure.
We're going to have a roundtable discussion, and we'll give it a go and see how this works out. But let's just start with a question about sustainability in general. There's a lot of talk about sustainability, it has been for the last few years. But when we talk environmental, economic, and social sustainability, I mean, haven't civilizations been concerned about those sorts of things since time immemorial? What's different about sustainability these days?
I think we have, at least in the United States, in the last few years, a culture that basically is saying, we know the world's resources are finite. People are understanding that we don't want to put things in landfills. We want to be able to use them again. And so we're going to do whatever we can to make that happen. Now, the thing is you have to balance what are the costs to do these. There are some things like on the industrial scrap that we handle. I mean, for some companies, that's their profit in a year. So it's not a question of you're just going to pick it up and you're doing them a favor. Not at all. But when it comes to municipal things, some of the material generated there, where maybe some of the values are very low, you're going to have to say, okay, am I willing to make sure that these are handled correctly, that they're recycled, and that they don't get into the landfills, even if there's a cost? And I think that's what's very important.
I think from an agricultural perspective, we're looking at how do we feed a growing world population. And in that population, people that in countries that are having a growing middle class that want diets like what you and I have here in the United States. And how do we do all of this by using less land, less water, less inputs, the nutrient inputs, and be able to meet this growing world demand that has geopolitical impacts and influences on top of all of that. So from an agricultural standpoint, sustainability is something that is getting a tremendous amount of attention. And with the ag leaders just in this past fall, the ag leaders of Michigan, we had Kellogg Company come in and address one of our events that was called Climate Change, Economics, and Agriculture. And sustainability was very much a part of that conversation.
You know, I had the good fortune of being down there. And, of course, you're talking 9.5 billion people across the globe now. Certainly food is going to be hugely important. Doug, what about sustainability now? What's different?
Well, I think what's already been said is, to me, is really the key here. We've really got a coming together of not only the growing population, but the lifestyle issues and the growing middle class and the needs, the higher needs of resources per individual, plus the fact of the growing population and how this comes together and how the millions and millions of people in the developing world, what kind of a lifestyle can they have within the context of the carrying capacity of the earth.
Related to it, and Diane, you brought this up a little bit in terms of agriculture, but Let's get into the whole issue of renewable energy, which certainly impacts agriculture when we talk about biofuels, renewable portfolio standards, Michigan's energy future. Mark, we'll come back to you. The importance of renewable energy from your perspective, renewable portfolio standards, is this something we need to continue to do? There are some folks that are arguing that we need to dump these renewable portfolio standards, including the American Petroleum Institute.
Well, obviously, for us, we look at costs, and for us, we have a huge fleet, and you know, what is the future going to be? What material? What are we going to use to fuel our equipment? Now, we made a conscious effort 2 years ago, and the fleet that we use to pick up containers from Michigan with the deposit are all natural gas trucks. Now we have 16 semis on the road, and we put 2 stations in. Because we believe, because of the carbon footprint, and it is the right thing to do, and the economics are there. But we see that from a standpoint of the future, that natural gas is going to be incredibly important to the strength of our economy and the ability for the United States to control our own energy needs.
Diane, you had some thoughts on these renewable energy portfolio standards and the importance of renewable.
Sure. Well, renewables clearly has a place in Michigan's energy future because it's really an all-of-the-above strategy. And when you take a look at the costs of coal, the fact that Michigan's fleet is very old, and that when the EPA rules that are on the horizon, that it's going to become very expensive to continue operating those old coal plants, coupled with the fact that Michigan doesn't produce any coal, so we're paying to transport it into our state. So what is the future? It looks like it's going to be natural gas for a lot of reasons, cost, economics primarily, as well as an integration with renewable energy, because natural gas and renewables work very well together. For agriculture, you've already seen wind farms and wind development, but when you look at more on-site, whether it is a farm homestead or it's an agribusiness, there's going to be opportunities for solar, a lot of rooftops out there. Solar's becoming much more affordable. You can integrate that with the grid. There's tremendous opportunity for a farm, biodigesters. And they also have the added benefit if we get into a cap and trade situation where you can sell those carbon credits, so that's additional income. So agriculture clearly needs to be part of a balanced energy future. And we should not forget energy efficiency. Tremendous opportunities to bring down those costs. And the energy costs are significant to any business. They're significant in agriculture across the board. So there's lots of opportunity as an energy future for Michigan with agriculture involved.
Doug, many of the things that Mark and Diane have mentioned are research projects that are going on at Michigan State University from a research perspective, many of which are sponsored by MSU Ag Bioresearch.
Yes, I think really, I don't want to date myself too much here, but I always think about the first time we went around on this, and some of us were a little older, was the 3 R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. And I was really glad that you finished up with your comment about energy efficiency, because I think in some of the discussions, I think we have underemphasized the opportunities to reduce energy use as well. So, when we look at our full portfolio of research, and it really spans a lot of different things. I mean, we support research, for example, on building materials and some of those types of things in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction. We're quite involved in anaerobic digesters. We've got a big new project on South Campus where we're putting campus waste, animal waste, off-campus waste, food waste into a digester to provide electricity for part of campus. So I think how we put all these things together, I think the really important point is that there isn't one solution out there. It's not necessarily solar. It's not wind. Because the amount of energy that we use, I think we sometimes forget just the massive scope of our current energy system, and to make any dent in that is going to take a long time, and it's going to take a lot of pieces. So I think an integrated approach that takes everything into considerations is going to be our ultimate solution.
You folks have mentioned natural gas. I want to come back to that in a second. But one thing that's been tremendously surprising, even the Consumers Energies and DTE Energies out there have been almost shocked by the cost of wind energy, for example, and how that's come down so dramatically. I mean, a lot of these renewables initially, a lot of R&D costs up front. But as technology gets better, those costs come down. So who knows what that portfolio is going to look like 10 years from now?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that you think about, and I'm certainly not a petroleum engineer, but you think about the current petrochemical system that we have was built over a century or more. And so that didn't start fully developed. And so anything that new that comes along, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, whether it's anything else, is going to take time to develop the infrastructure and those types of things. As you said, the cost is going to come down. Efficiencies are going to go up. New technologies are going to come along. And I think as we look at it as a growing and learning process like we do with most of our major systems, I think we can make some real progress.
And that's exactly what the experience has been with Michigan's Energy Portfolio Standard. The 2008 law set the goal of 10% renewable energy by 2015. And the utilities found that they could meet that goal ahead of time. Even the governor's own reports coming out saying that 35% by 2030 is clearly doable within today's technology. And when you look at how you integrate that with natural gas, it works very, very well. So there's lots of opportunity, and you're right. It is an evolution of technology, and we've seen that happen in the telecommunications field. And that should be the roadmap or the vision of what we can see happening with electricity into the future.
Mark, you mentioned natural gas a while back in one of your comments, and that you're moving to that. Any concerns that you have about an issue that's much in the news, and that's how we get the natural gas and hydraulic fracturing?
Well, generally, I certainly appreciate environmentalists, their concerns, and I have the confidence, though, that what is needed to make sure we safeguard the environment, the things that are needed will be done. If anything, especially today, sometimes I think we even have overkill for certain things. And I just want to make sure that we don't have a fear, like the China syndrome thing that basically eliminated nuclear power from the United States, which I have my own feeling there, because I'm actually pro-nuclear power. But I think it'll continue, and again, they'll find better ways to protect the environment. And if there's areas where it absolutely is going to cause potential danger, I think they won't be allowed to drill.
Just recently, the Department of Environmental Quality had posted that they are going to be pursuing some additional regulations and rulemaking safeguards, if you will, as it relates to hydraulic fracking for natural gas exploration in Michigan. And what they're proposing is disclosure of chemicals. Many states have moved in that direction so that those that are engaging in that extraction of natural gas must disclose the chemical mix that they're using.
The chemical mix in the fracking fluid.
Fracking fluid, mm-hmm. As well as the tracking of water, using a water resource tool and including that, because there are tremendous one-time draws of water to use fracking. And so with those additional safeguards in Michigan, we are on the right path for responsible environmental regulation as it relates to hydraulic fracking for natural gas exploration. And those are seen as reasonable regulations, and in fact, it is what other states are doing. And Michigan does have some issues and some concerns with water. Water access, you know, we've got some water table issues in certain parts of the state. We are having increased use of irrigation as a risk management tool in agriculture, as well as water quality within the Great Lakes system, particularly the western basin of Lake Erie.
Doug, any thoughts on hydraulic fracturing?
Well,
University of Michigan's doing some work on that.
I think the issue that Diane brought up at the end here, I think, is really an important one. If these other issues can be worked out, I think that, you know, the water use, the withdrawal, because we know how precious the water resource is, and it's even in Michigan, it's not an unlimited supply. And so I think we really have to look at that as how does that fit in with other uses. How are aquifers replenished when these things happen? Because we know that that's really an issue. And I think, as you've pointed out already, with some of the increased irrigation in the southwest corner of the state, we're already seeing some things that are causing some concerns. And so I think that would just add to that issue to make sure that we understand these withdrawal and return rates.
And I look at Michigan, our future economically. There are areas of the country, quite frankly, that are not going to be able to grow industrially because they do not have the water. I think in the next 5 years, or whether it's 5 years from now, Michigan is going to be very attractive as far as industrial growth, and that water resource is going to be absolutely is going to drive companies to Michigan.
Oh, and I absolutely agree with you, Mark. There was a discussion that one of our ALM members, the Agribusiness Association, had over in Muskegon last week on the potential of barge traffic up Lake Michigan as far north as Muskegon and that water transportation, too. We had a situation where we had an international shipment of fertilizer come into the Saginaw River around Thanksgiving. So water clearly is one of the big value propositions we have in Michigan, and we're going to be the envy of many states, if not the world. We still have serious concerns on water quality. And to Michigan's credit, we have been ahead of the game when it comes to water quality. We took with our lawn fertilizer, we took the phosphorus out of our land, of our lawn fertilizer many years ago, our dish soap many years ago. Other states did not do that. And we have an agronomy applicators that are highly trained, and they make sure that they're applying fertilizer at the right time, the right place, at the right rate. And so we practice good agronomy practices here in Michigan, all with an eye towards water quality.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and we're seeing that play out a little bit in the southwest corner of the state relative to some of the issues in Lake Erie, where they're looking at where the problems are coming from, and there's a lot more of a target on some of the practices that are still occurring in Ohio as opposed to where we're already at in Michigan. And so having been in some regional meetings, there's a lot more changes, and as I said, looking at that issue, it's going to have a much bigger impact in Ohio than it is in Michigan because of the things that we've already done that Diane just mentioned.
Well, yeah, a major area of emphasis for MSU Ag Bio is water research, and certainly Ag Leaders of Michigan, a water Shupan and Sons, certainly importance of water. What about this interface between water and energy, though, that helped us get to, you know, if we're going to do hydraulic fracturing, it takes a lot of water. How much water are we going to need for wind turbine generation or solar or ethanol production or what have you? Some people are saying that this interface between energy and water is really will constitute the most serious challenges that we have to deal with in the coming 10 to 20 years.
Well,
Any comments on that?
Well, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier. It's this understanding, you're right, these competing uses, what are the value of those competing uses? How much can we sustainably withdraw? You know, we're seeing some of the things out west with the Ogallala Aquifer. I mean, that's not a good trend out there. So we have to learn from those experiences and realize that that is, to some extent, a finite resource and make sure that there is a balance in how it's used for food, for energy. And we haven't talked much about some of the recreation issues and how these things impact trout streams, those types of things, which are also, you know, when the governor talks about the big three, agriculture, manufacturing, and tourism, that's an interface and an interaction that right. We also have to keep mindful to.
Right. Water is clearly an issue. It is an issue today, but it's an emerging issue that is going to define Michigan's economic viability. And in Michigan, because we're surrounded by the Great Lakes, people are passionate about water. It defines us as a culture, as a state. And so there are lots of big issues on water, both today and on the horizon. The good news is Michigan has been very proactive, and they've done this with sound science, through research, collaborative approaches, and so that all of the uses of the water, of the aquifer, are taken into consideration and there's a balance. And as long as we proceed that way into the future, then the future is very bright for Michigan. There's a place for industry. There's a place for agriculture. There's a place for tourism. There's a place for research to pull all of this together for best practices.
Mark, from the manufacturing perspective, what are some things about the water issue that concern you going forward?
Well, we've been concerned for a long time because how groundwater is handled at all facilities and where it does go and what the potential is has been important. And we've worked with the DEQ to make sure we have best practices and to make sure that with the recycling we do and the industrial and the steel and all these other things, that we make sure that we contain any potential pollution. And it costs money to do it, but it's part of the expectation of what you should do, and we're going to continue to do the right things.
another part of this water issue, and then we'll move on to something else. And Doug, you alluded to it in terms of recreation, but we also have invasive species issues out there. We do have problems with phosphorus contamination in Lake Erie. I mean, there are a plethora of issues related to water that are going to have to be dealt with.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you hit on one, and we don't have time to get into it today. I think it could probably be an idea for a story for you next year, is the whole invasive species issue, because it's not just in the water. There are invasive species in terms of we've seen things like emerald ash borer. We have, you know, spotted wing Drosophila. We have all sorts of things going on. And the interaction of climate change and the areas of adaptation for different pest species is something that is looming out there. And so actually one of the things we've been talking about is looking about starting to pull together the different scientists that we have, everything from fisheries and wildlife to entomology to pathology and so on, to really look at our capacity as a university around invasive species, because a lot of the same basic ecological principles work in a lake that work in a farm field and work in a lot of other systems in between.
You guys just alluded to it, and we didn't script this. I want our listeners to know that we did not script this, but Doug, you actually mentioned climate change. I would be remiss if I didn't throw the climate change argument. I was listening to CNN the other night, and there was a debate going on about, is climate change real, despite the fact that most of the science is pretty clear on it. Your perspectives on climate change and, what's going to happen with that debate? Do we need to get out of the debate and on to something else? Will the debate continue to rage? Your perspectives on the climate change debate.
Well, I think the climate change debate or discussion is ongoing, and it's been ongoing in spades in Michigan, and we've seen it on many different fronts. One of them is just these extreme weather events. We lost almost the entire cherry and apple crop a year ago because of a very early spring. I remember 80-degree plus temperatures on March 17th, followed by a very hard frost. Specialty crops can't survive that. You have the expansion with longer growing days and new biotechnology for seed varieties that are allowing an expansion of commodity production in northern Michigan. You're even seeing it across the bridge with potato expansion of potato crops, as well as we're going to have a test plot for navy beans across the bridge next year in Michigan. So the discussion is going on. So it's really the realization that climate change is here. It has happened in Michigan. And I really think we're starting to take that next step, and that's recognition and resiliency strategies. So how do we handle these extreme weather events, the droughts, the floods, the frost, the early frost, the unpredictability of spring weather? We didn't have a frost this year until well into the end of November, which extended corn harvest,
right,
and which helped corn, but it didn't necessarily help soybeans all that much. So a lot's going on, and it's going to be focusing on irrigation, cover crops, how you apply nutrients. Those kinds of resiliency strategies is where Michigan's dialogue is going to go.
Diane weighed in on climate change. Mark, Doug, what's your take on it? We'll start with
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. Let me continue, because I think a lot of the things that Diane already mentioned, I would absolutely agree with. I think to me that from my perspective, as we look at it from our science and the work we do, I think there's kind of in some ways two separate issues. We've seen real changes in weather patterns in Michigan. We can debate what the cause of that is, but those things are real. And one of the things about Michigan that is fairly unique is that we have some very sensitive cropping systems. You mentioned the apples and the cherries. A very few, very small changes in climate, a few warm days at the wrong time followed by a freeze at the wrong time, completely can wipe out that crop. The juice grape industry has probably been hit the hardest with that. And so we really need to be out front on this, because we have some industries that are very important to us that could be at risk, particularly apples, where there's a lot of competition from other parts of the country. So that's another big piece of it. The other piece, obviously, is understanding the real causes of it. But to me, from the shorter term, the agricultural systems perspective, we really have to look at, accept the fact that some changes have happened. And if it's natural cycling or a basic climate change, in some ways, in the short term, that doesn't make a lot of difference. That's a separate issue that we also have to come to grips with. But we have cropping systems that could be teetering on the edge if we have more of this type of weather. And we can't live with that because it'll be gone.
Mark?
You know, when I look at, and again, big picture, and I think in terms of, you know, how do we reduce carbon that could be affecting certainly, you know, climate changes. And I think in terms of, you know, what could we do to get China to, you know, to have less pollution. And then I also look at what happens with all the things, the restrictions that we want to try to do to make sure that it's better. And we have one volcano, and you multiply what that volcano puts into the atmosphere compared to what we tried to just reduce. Mother Nature is pretty hard to control, I'm sure of that. And I, I think there certainly is something going on because if you look at the extreme weather patterns we've had, but I'm not so sure we can pinpoint it to any industry or to whatever. But I know that it'd be good to try to at least do our part to make it better, even if we're not sure.
Yeah, there are some who suggest that let's get off of the causality here and look at the data. Causality will be determined ultimately by the science. But what's wrong with doing things that are good for the environment while this debate is basically unfolds? And I think what we've been talking about for the last hour suggests that all three of you would believe we do the right things for the environment because it's the right thing to do.
Well, absolutely. And for agriculture, when you look at resiliency strategies or mitigation, it's really about economics. How do you manage risk? Given the unpredictability and the extreme weather events that are happening, there are management practices that can reduce risk and that can protect that farmer, that agribusiness against loss. And so that's really what we're focusing on. They make economic sense. And that's the way the industry has positioned themselves. And then you couple that with sustainability and what the market, those that buy the products that agriculture produces, are requiring, then they all work together and they have a positive impact when it comes to what can we do to minimize our carbon footprint as an industry broadly.
Yeah, and I just follow that up, putting a little bit of a plug in for a long-term fundamental research, because when you talk about the resiliency, continuing to advance our understanding of the genetics of both our crop plants and animals, so that there is more resiliency, there's drought resistance, there's more cold tolerance, things like that, that can help us even weather a few more degrees at some of these key points, could have absolutely huge impacts. And that is those are not projects, and those are not things that are done in a year or two. And so I think we really need to remember that some of the things that we're seeing in the field today really had their starts 25 or 30 years ago in an obscure lab somewhere, and we need to continue to make that investment to keep that pipeline full of new innovation, because we will continue to have challenges regardless of some of these things we're talking about today.
I would echo that. I absolutely agree with Doug.
And I feel I'm very fortunate. I'm in an industry which I've been in for a long time, but when you look at, we'll do 400 million pounds of metal or plastic this year that we'll recycle. The aluminum can, 92% savings in energy by recycling it. And you do the multipliers, how much energy, how much water, how much carbon are we not burning? And so I feel very glad that I'm in an industry that can make a difference.
We have just a few minutes left here, but I like to close my interviews, as you folks know, with a sort of a broad-ranging question I'd like each of you to respond to. We've alluded to a lot of these things, but, you know, again, with 9.5 billion people projected on the planet, major U.S. and global challenges politically, environmentally, what have you, what are some things that worry you looking forward for the next 5 to 10 years from your own perspectives? With respect to sustainability.
Well, I'll take a shot, I guess. I think the thing that I really wonder, and I know we've talked about this for a long time and it hasn't happened yet, but you know, I think an issue of if, in fact, we do reach 9.5 billion people or beyond, you know, what kind of a standard of living, you know, can that many people have? When you see the, you know, situations in places like India and China with that number of people, can the Earth support that high of a standard of living for that many people, and what is ultimately the carrying capacity? And I think that's going to create some very serious questions on a lot of things as we move forward.
Again, I look at balance. Just read a book regarding the coming jobs war. And from what do people want in the world? They want a job. They want an opportunity. And if they don't have these, we have all the things that can happen. I just came from Brazil a few weeks ago, and it was interesting. From a balance standpoint, we know that in the United States, I'm not sure what the figure is, but we waste like 30 or 40% of our food, okay? And we have populations around the world that are hungry. Now, what would happen if we didn't have that waste, if it could be used in another way? Could we raise the tide and make it a better world? So I know that's sounds like a pipe dream, but I think there's a lot of things we can do. So
I think both Doug and Mark have articulated where I would say what worries me into the future. One thing that I keep coming back to, though, is that agriculture is really part and parcel of that future. And what's going on in agriculture today were the dreams and the vision of what was being talked about when I was going through the College of Agriculture in the 70s, that it's really happening today. And agriculture is at the crossroads of all of these major issues, whether it's sustainability, water, energy, food, standard of living. And so from that perspective, I think we here at Michigan State University, the work that Doug is doing and many of the colleges are well positioned to use that land grant mission that we have here at Michigan State University for the betterment of mankind into the future.
And on that very positive note, along with a very positive Rose Bowl appearance by the Michigan State Spartans, and I know we have three Spartan fans at this table, I'd like to thank our sustainability panel. I've been talking with Diane Byram. She is a co-founder and partner of Byram and Fisk Advocacy Communications, also a spokesperson for the Agricultural Leaders of Michigan. Mark Shupan, Chief Executive Officer of Shupan and Sons, Inc., which is headquartered in Kalamazoo. Very good partners with Michigan State University. And good friend Doug Bueller, who is the Director of MSU Ag Bio Research. And I'd like to thank all three of you for being on the panel, but also for your continuing support of the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Happy holidays.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze in our Greening of the Great Lakes segment here on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please find more online at mlive.com/environment.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we welcome back to the program good friend Dr. Chris Peterson. He's the Homer Nolan Chair of Consumer Responsive Agriculture and Professor of Agricultural Food and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. He is also the Director of the MSU Product Center Food Ag Bio. Chris, welcome back to the program.
It is a pleasure to join you once again.
Chris, I also would be remiss if I didn't mention that our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research help support the work of the Product Center.
Absolutely, as do the folks at Michigan State University Extension.
Chris, you are celebrating 10 years. Can you believe it's been 10 years from now? Remind our listeners when this all got started. What is the purpose? What's the mission, Product Center?
Well, in the latter part of the 1990s and into the early 2000s, the watchword was value-added agriculture, the notion that we really needed to not just think about agriculture as the commodities that come off the off the fields or out of the barns, but it really has to be about the products that those things get converted into, thus the name of the Product Center. And originally we were the Product Center for Agriculture and Natural Resources, and subsequently we morphed the name into the Food Ag Bio to better reflect the fact that we're working directly with entrepreneurs, brand new entrepreneurs, as well as existing businesses that want to take a new product or service to market that has something to do with food, agriculture, or bioproducts. And it has been an exciting 10 years. We've actually done, I think, very, very well. And I'll give you a couple of the 10-year statistics. We've actually now had over 30,000 one-on-one client sessions 10-year period.
Wow.
We've assisted roughly 2,800 clients in developing a first business concept. The 2,800 went on, 1,500 of them went on to actually start up their business. And then of those 1,500, over 350 actually created economic activity. That is, they really launched the business in some significant way. And so we are immensely proud of that record of accomplishment. Of those 350-some ventures, that represents about $320 million of annual new sales.
Wow.
In the state, and 1,700 jobs created and retained over the 10 years. So we're thrilled.
That's a remarkable track record that over a 10-year period. Chris, when you look back over those 10 years, you mentioned all of these client meetings, those that came to fruition with businesses that are generating economic revenue. Can you give us a couple of examples of maybe a couple of those businesses that are maybe near and dear to your heart?
Well, I think one of the ones that we're very, very proud of is all the work that we did with the Michigan turkey producers. Primarily, we were able to use our designation by USDA as a cooperative development center to work with them in developing their cook plant and all of their branded products that have just been immensely successful in the marketplace. So I think as a very big project, that was something that we're very proud of. Another project is Legends of the Lake, which is Great Lake whitefish. Those independent fisheries were really going to go out of business. And there was one year as we started to work with them that the wholesale price of a pound of Great Lakes whitefish fell to 99 cents. And the industry
that was not sustainable.
That's correct. So we helped the fisheries come together over several years, form a cooperative where they could increase the quality of their product. They created a brand name. They now go to market under the Legends of the Lake brand name. And now we're talking about $6-$7 pound for wholesale and a really high quality product, and it's been an immense success. At the other end of the continuum, we've helped lots of smaller organizations develop a whole bunch of specialty food items, salsas, jams, jellies, a tremendous number of gluten-free products. I mean, the range of things that that we've gotten into across these various entrepreneurs and existing food processors. It's been wonderful.
A range, a spectrum that 10 years ago you could scarcely have envisioned.
Yes, I think we had our hopes 10 years ago, and I think of myself as the entrepreneur who started the Product Center, and it really has been an exciting ride.
My guest is Dr. Chris Peterson, and he's the director of the MSU Product Center Food Ag Bio. Chris, as you look forward, let's talk about the next 10 years. You look at the Michigan food and ag and bio sector. Michigan certainly has some advantages. There's been a lot of good news in that sector. What are some of Michigan's major advantages going forward?
Well, I think it is still the fact that we have an incredible diversity of agricultural goods here in the state, both in terms of what happens on the farm and then the ability to process those into specialty foods and other end consumer products. And I think we have a unique opportunity to pull together that diversity of product with the fact that unlike some other places, we have an abundance of water. We have a strong food processing industry that, in fact, has the potential to expand, I think, even dramatically. And those are the really, really positive things. And one thing that we are working on as the Product Center is the creation of a Food Processing and Innovation Center for Michigan State University, where we're going to be able to help the more middle to larger size food processor actually come and do product R&D. We're going to be able on a plug and play kind of basis to have them create a whole production line right on the floor of the center. And they'll be able to experiment with different ways of processing. We're going to have a spiral freezer. Now, this all depends on getting the money to have it happen, but we do have a very extensive business plan and feasibility study. It's roughly a $5 million project, and we're now moving into the fundraising phase of that.
So this R&D capacity, and correct me if I'm wrong, that fills a niche. Some of the larger companies, I would think, like the Kellogg's and the Gerber's, have their own capacity. You're talking about more of a mid-tier and smaller operation.
Correct. We're talking about the $5 million to even $50 million food processing operation. Where in many instances they're operating at capacity or close to it such that they really can't use their own production space to really experiment with a new product line that might help them move dramatically into a growth phase. And so they're going to be able to rent the facilities, come in, do their work. They can tap into the expertise of our packaging and food processing faculty here on campus. Even we hope, we think there'll be opportunities for senior undergraduates and even graduate students to do internships with these kind of businesses on the processing side. I think there's a remarkable array of things that can be done with a facility like this. And there isn't a facility like this in the Great Lakes region that we represent. And particularly with this flexible plug-and-play idea, I think we're going to have a unique facility that can really help generate growth in the sector.
A facility that brings together and leverages a lot of resources that Michigan State already has, but doesn't
Correct.
Necessarily work in sync.
Because in essence, if you begin to imagine that we have the Food Processing Innovation Center and connect that to the dairy lab and the meat lab, the packaging labs on campus, and there is also a plan being developed out of food science to dramatically reinvigorate the fresh fruit and vegetable processing possibilities. If we could get all of these assets in place, MSU would truly be the food university.
Well, Chris, the Product Center, 10 years of entrepreneurial activity. You're looking at the next 10 years, and as we speak, you're right in the middle of this new entrepreneurial activity. I mean, what a great story. Congratulations on your 10-year anniversary, Chris, and best of luck going forward with the Product Center.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. When I first came to Michigan State University in 1973, many of my friends at Ann Arbor Pioneer High School wanted to know why. There was a Big Ten school in my backyard. Both of my parents had earned degrees there. I had been accepted for admission. Why would a potential third-generation Wolverine want to come to East Lansing? My answer? I want to become a Spartan. I now realize that on that first day I set foot on the Michigan State campus, I had no idea of the true meaning of that word. It is only now, with the seasoning of the years, that I am just beginning to understand. Being a Spartan isn't a degree, a t-shirt, a title, or a trophy. It's an ethic, a lifestyle, a set of beliefs and behaviors that set us apart from the rest of the world, even as we work together in pursuit of a better life for everyone. A Spartan is something you choose to become. It is integrity, fairness, morality, honor, generosity, tenacity, kindness, and assurance, elements that combine to forge an iron constitution and a compassionate heart. Therefore, I am a Spartan. I emerge from the most modest of backgrounds and from the most prominent of families. The blood of every race, creed, color, and culture flows green within my veins. My story is uniquely mine, but I work together with others to become a leader, a lifesaver, and a world changer. I am a Spartan. I read the classics, create art, and study the fundamental laws of the universe. I unlock the secrets of science, create businesses, appreciate the beauty of a symphony, and the power of the written word, reforming the insights from my research into ideas that can change the way of life for people I will never meet. I am a Spartan. I may make three-point shots, swim faster, and run further, but I know that a broad, lifelong educational experience will contribute to my inevitable success on and off the athletic field. I am a Spartan. I contribute at every level, in every community. I feed the world, heal the sick, teach the children, and invent, improve, and envision great ideas that lead to great accomplishment. I am a Spartan. I create drugs, discipline, and doctrine that strengthen the weak, bring hope where there is despair, and prolong the quality and quantity of life for the afflicted until I can find a cure. I am a Spartan. I may not always score the most points, but I am never beaten. I learn from experience, get up when I stumble, and am ultimately victorious in every endeavor I undertake. I am a Spartan. I celebrate differences, knowing that if we can discuss and debate from a place of diversity, we are more likely to make the right decisions when we act as one. I am a Spartan. I have known pain, disappointment, and struggle, but I realize that only the hottest fire refines a Spartan's resolve, and it is both trial and triumph that build character. I may achieve success, but I remain humble because I know that the greatest among us are defined not by our position, but by our kindness, caring, and humility. I am a Spartan. I am among the first to offer a hand to those in need, regardless of who they are or where they come from. When others complain, I seek to understand. When others give up, I go the extra mile. While others may dream of the future, I am committed to creating it. I am a Spartan. I believe that what has happened in the past gives me perspective. But it is where I am going that makes all the difference. I honor those who came before, seek to learn from those who would teach me, and live my life so that Spartans who have passed on will be proud. I am a Spartan. I live the core values of the institution that educated me and devote my time, talent, and treasure to create a margin of excellence that ensures, enriches, and sustains Michigan State University for future generations. I am a Spartan. My dedication to the greater good is unmatched. My determination is unbroken. My compassion is legendary. And the common connection I share with my 500,000 fellow Spartans sustains and strengthens me in everything I do. And when my earthly tale is told, and I look down from the precipice of the ages, other Spartans will stand beside me, just as every Spartan, past, present, and future, will stand beside you. We will pick you up when you stumble, guide you in the direction of goodness, and celebrate the day when you can look into the heavens and truly declare, I am a Spartan. Others may associate these things with their university, their faith, or their chosen profession. That's okay. Those who live the Spartan ethic, though they may never set foot on the Michigan State University campus, are part of the Spartan spirit, even though they may never realize it. If you would endeavor to incorporate these beliefs and behaviors into your life, I promise you that you will find fulfillment in whatever you may decide to do. And whoever you become, there will be a quiet voice within you that will, in its own unique language, someday whisper, I am a Spartan. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about the Spartan life at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises MSU.
Alumni.msu.edu. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.